everybody, and welcome to the Foreign Press Association for yet another Zoom briefing on events around Ukraine. Speaking to David Adler, who had a commentary in The Guardian a week ago, which echoed the commentary of many other people, amongst the triumphalism of getting a vote against Russia in the UN General Assembly, he pointed out the strange omissions. That the global south wasn't there. And this is something I addressed in an op-ed or a commentary for the Quincy Institute. I've been following the United Nations for many years now. And I was in when the Palestinians reinvented the Uniting for Peace procedure, wherein lies a clue. As I pointed out in my piece, for the last 20 years, the United States has been constantly denigrating and, how should we say, defanging the Uniting for Peace procedure because it was being used to stop an unreasonable veto by a superpower, namely the US, against for events in the Middle East. And now the chicken hawks have come home to roost, as it were, is that people are shouting that the UN has passed this resolution and forgetting that the country that's doing the shouting about this is the one that's done its best to make sure these resolutions are unavailing over the years. So, David, you looked at the patterns there, and there's some anomalies, like the French have stopped managing to whip in the Francophone African countries. The British never really tried with the British, with the old Commonwealth countries. Of all the blocks still handling, if the ghost of the non-alliance still seems to be alive, seems to be haunting the United Nations chamber, what is your take on the distribution of the vote and what it means about actual sentiment?
Yeah, well, I think we can look at two very different maps that tell two very different stories. The first map is the one that you referred to now, Ian, which is the map of the condemnation of the, quote, Russian aggression in Ukraine, that was held in emergency session earlier this month, in which case we can see a really large, I mean, certainly not covering most of the surface of the globe, but a huge number of countries, 135 countries, did indeed vote to condemn that invasion. Important abstentions from countries like India, China, Bangladesh, that we need to think about the motivations and the consequences of those abstentions. Certainly, the U.S. is already weighing sanctions against a country like India. We saw, you know, the cancellation of a COVID-19 vaccine shipment from Lithuania to Bangladesh because of its abstention. So there already are a certain geopolitics that pertain to the U.N. resolution itself. But the core argument that I make in this piece is to direct our attention away from the U.N. map and towards the map of sanctions set against Russia. Now, sanctions are the fundamental content, the actual substance of the war effort against Russia, right? This is the most intense kind of declaration of war that's been set by the US and its allies in Europe against Russia, against its people, set out, as Jen Psaki said yesterday, to cripple the Russian economy and deplete Russian resources. So I think the more critical question is, beyond the diplomatic theater of the United Nations and those votes, which are, of course, critical in the signals they send and the alliances they portend, to actually look at how countries are engaged in that form of economic warfare against Russia. And there we find a completely different map than the United Nations condemnation. Basically, no country beyond a fortified coalition of South Korea, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, Canada, the United States, and the EU has taken on sanctions against Russia. That includes NATO members like Turkey. And of course, it includes those large countries that abstain from the UN vote, China, India, Bangladesh. But far more importantly, I think in terms of making sense of geopolitics in the age of multipolarity, it's countries that the US otherwise considers broadly on side in creating that kind of summit for democracy, that club of democracies that Joe Biden has been very committed to. Countries like Mexico, countries like Argentina, countries across Africa that the US would like to corral into its club as it moves towards a more Cold War footing vis-a-vis Russia, and of course, more importantly, vis-a-vis China. So I'm suggesting that we need to look at the substance of the foreign political conversation, the actual ways in which these countries are or are not engaged in that war beyond simply the rhetorical expressions of their governments at the UN General Assembly, to get a grip on what geopolitics might look like in the world that is coming to form in the course of this war between Russia, the United States, and its allies.
I mean, there are, as you differentiate there, there are several different aspects. Most countries disapprove of the invasion unequivocally. You know, it's complete violation of the UN Charter, which is based on the non-acquisition of territory by force, that you don't take military action without Security Council approval, et cetera, et cetera. But there's also the question of the sanctions, because once again, mostly through US abuse of sanctions over Iraq, Cuba, and so on, there is a sanctions fatigue amongst many, many countries who saw what was done when the US maintained and the UK maintained sanctions on Iraq years after there was any significant majority for them in the United Nations. There was immediately after the invasion of Kuwait, but through a sort of legalistic leisure domain, the West managed to maintain sanctions there for many decades after. And these were famously, that Madeleine Albright said, were worth it when she was asked if it was worth 500,000 dead Iraqi children. Yes, we think it was worth it. She has since tried to eat her words, but it's a bit too much. She's choked on them. And understandably, and that's the attitude that the rest of the world goes, is the US wielding its power to fight its, direct bilateral missions. Iran is a case in point. You know, most countries are neutral about Iran. Very few are that concerned to the extent that they want to apply sanctions. But the US is applying sanctions in their name with all of these tools that we're talking about now, the SWIFT codes and the bank transfers, and accelerating in a way a push towards alternatives. It hasn't succeeded yet to the dollar as the unit of currency. So there's sanctions fatigue. There's, how should we say, ethical fatigue. You know, why is the US taking this action when it doesn't do anything about the Golan Heights, doesn't know anything about Western Sahara, doesn't do anything about the multifarious other places where there've been almost as equal defaults on human rights and international law? Or, you know, if you were in Africa, you could say the biggest war that's been going on for 30 or 40 years is the Congo, in which the United Nations and the international powers have basically just taken the minerals to make their cell phones and let them rot. So that there is a lot of compassion fatigue here, or indignation fatigue, that we could say. All of these factors together, or would you like to assess the different proportions amongst the voting?
Yeah, I think that there are various motivations for this stance of neutrality, and we'll get into a bit of whether this is signaling non-alignment, which is a more ambitious and more principled position that obviously has a major historical referent in the movement that emerged, led by Nehru and Tito in the 50s. So, you know, fatigue is certainly one way of putting it. I think there's a lot of kind of fatigue in terms of managing the hypocrisies and the contradictions that run through US foreign policy in particular. I think when it comes to countries in Latin America, you know, I'll read a couple quotes from the Mexicans and the Argentines. The Mexicans say, "We do not consider this war concerns us." This is the president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, speaking. "We are not going to take any sort of economic reprisal because we want to have good relations with all governments." So I think that gets us more towards that non-alignment. But the Argentines are an even better case, because the Argentines, of course, voted to condemn Russia's actions at the UN, saying, you know, along the lines you say, Ian, it's illegal, it violates every, you know, the various principles and statutes of international law. But they said, "Argentina does not consider that sanctions are a mechanism to generate peace and harmony or generate a frank dialogue table that serves to save lives." Now, a lot of this is so commonsensical in most parts of the world. And I think, you know, my good friend Nick Mulder, who has a great book out, a new book on the history of sanctions called The Economic Weapon, he says, you know, sanctions are the foreign policy key that fits all locks, but we don't really know what door it opens, right? So you can always respond with sanctions. And it comes, I think, from our inability, the United States speaking as a person from the United States, from our inability to accept that there would be a foreign policy, a foreign conflict anywhere in the world to which we could not have a response, right? So sanctions are this way where we say, we're doing something, We're taking them on. We're taking them on how? The history of sanctions actually resulting in the policy and political changes we seek in the world is disastrous. Almost in no cases, speaking over the past 100 years, have sanctions resulted in the types of democratization or liberalization reforms that we seek to find in those countries. More often, they result in the destitution, in the death of their domestic populations, and in the cases of many of our so-called adversaries, increasing authoritarian grips of the governments we seek to depose. So that record, you know, is just—
Well, in Yugoslavia, they became a profit center because the ruling oligarchy were making out like bandits on smuggling.
Exactly.
Gasoline and cigarettes across the border. Yeah, so it's totally. Actually, we actually handed them a taxing point to enrich their own coffers.
Exactly. So sanctions also, you know, we think that they are going to apply this pressure to democratize. In fact, what they do is they criminalize all of society. They force people across Russia, across these societies, to resort to illegal means, and they massively incentivize the formation of gangs, of oligarchs, you know, taking advantage of loopholes to which only they have access because of their international connections. It's disastrous. Now, the question is why? Why is this so hard for the United States to accept, whereas for other countries it's so visible? The reason why I bring this up is because I think that for countries like Mexico and Argentina, which often find themselves on the wrong side of the Monroe Doctrine, namely saying, you know, we want our right to assert our sovereignty against the kind of pressures from the US.
Sovereignty, I remember that word, yes.
you know, for those countries, it's not fatigue, it's fear. You know, they are really scared that they could be the object of sanctions from the same kind of trigger-happy sanctions regime in Washington, right? That just responds to everything they don't like in the hemisphere and beyond by applying sanctions. So for them, it's a principle position. Sanctions don't work. They're not going to help, which, of course, they're not going to help. I think it shouldn't be controversial for us to recognize that in the case of Russia, there's no clear path to the sanctions resulting in the end of the invasion. And then principally, you know, they don't want to be seen to be endorsing a sanctions regime that could easily whip back around and hit them in the years to come.
Right? Well, after Iraq, we got into the regime of into the vocabulary of targeted sanctions. So instead of starving a whole country, where you, in the case of Russia, attack the oligarchs and the elites. And I mean, that's on the face of it seems quite reasonable, except there's no sign that Putin listens to them very much.
Well, there's a couple things. First, you know, there is good research on whether targeted sanctions work in the direction that I'm talking about. I think targeted sanctions are a very interesting, novel, you know, very, very important innovation in the way that we understand the politics of sanctions. What's so interesting about the Russian case is that nuance, which, by the way, shouldn't be so nuanced because it is also a violation of international law. Collective punishment is also like a flagrant violation of every principle that we claim to uphold. So we can also get into that. The hypocrisies, even in our approach to the defense of international law at the level of the UN. But my point is to say that what's so interesting about the Russian case is in the course of 2 weeks, all of that nuance, all of that drift towards more target, more attention to who's actually suffering from sanctions went out the window. We're just like, screw it. Let's just punish all of Russia.
Along with Tchaikovsky, Dostoevsky.
Yeah, and that's, of course, those are more decentralized.
Freedom fry country.
Exactly. So that's more of like a sort of generalized McCarthyite Cold War mentality, which is difficult to control. That's kind of a cat that gets out of the bag. I'm talking about the White House, who is very honest about what they're trying to do. They're trying to impoverish and destroy all of Russia to apply, as they tried in Cuba, basically, use destitution to drive democratization. And that link, I mean, that link has never held, it's never worked, it often backfires, so it doesn't make sense. So let's go back to that map of sanctions. You know, there's also a kind of savvy dimension to this, like, guys, we don't believe in these interventions, even if we condemn the invasion, we're not going to join the war effort. But I think it also—
If you remember James Baker, the Baker principle here, he said in the Balkans, we don't have a dog in that fight. So he didn't care how many Bosniaks Milosevic killed or how many Croatians he slaughtered. We don't have a dog in that fight. And that's surely not the clarion call, but the muted whisper from people all over the world. What's it got to do with us?
Yeah. So I think that they're caught between a rock. Many of these countries in the global south are caught between a rock and a hard place. The rock is that, you know, they, as you said, Ian, you know, they want it. They do feel themselves vulnerable to the same kinds of invasions and violations of international law that we see on display in Ukraine, as we also saw on display in the past 30 years of basically unipolar rule by the United States across the world, right? That's something that they feel nervous about being on the other side of. But the other thing, which I think is gets to the point of the article and the more predictive aspects of it, is that, you know, in the age of unipolarity, these countries were really forced to take a side. They really had to say, okay, we're either with the United States or we're taking this big stand against the United States. And there are some cases in which groups of countries tried to band together to resist that, you know, like we saw in the Pink Tide in Latin America, the BRICS, the formation of UNASUR, the blocs that tried to say, you know, we're going to resist the unipolar moment. But I think that what we're seeing now in that map of sanctions is the recognition that that unipolar moment is now becoming a more multipolar moment. That these countries are going to be squeezed and counterposed between multiple great powers, between the Chinese, between the Russians, and the United States. And in that context of a more multipolar world, you don't just have to choose between compliance and resistance. Neutrality, non-alignment becomes a real geopolitical position in the same way that it was in the Cold War, the first Cold War. So I think that, you know, I really start from the position that I've been doing a lot of introspection. You know, I work in international politics, thinking about what exactly this tells us, this war is telling us. And to me, the main thing that it tells us is that the second Cold War has started in earnest. And we've been talking a lot about, are we entering a Cold War with China, blah, blah, blah. I think that what this tells us, as well as the eviction of Tchaikovsky and Russian cats and, you know, Russian ballerinas, you know, we are back in the Cold War. And I think this is a dry run for what we'll see with the Chinese as well.
But this is the case where the non-aligned almost comes back into its own, because during the last 20 years, one of the things I had noticed was how pervasive the non-aligned was as a concept, even though no one was quite sure who they were not aligning with anymore for a long period. But somehow those relationships, and you mentioned them before, Tito, Nehru, Milosevic drew support from that, even though Milosevic was no Tito. He wasn't anti-imperialist. He wasn't even anti-capitalist. He wasn't even a socialist, social democrat. He was a kleptomaniac. But he still garnered diplomatic support from the former countries of the non-aligned because of the sort of relationships and penumbra that had built up around them.
I think that when it comes to non-alignment, you know, one of the criticisms I've gotten for the piece is to say, you know, non-alignment, well, a lot of the position that these countries are taking against sanctions is not a principled one, it's transactional. Russia supports them with oil or with arms, whatever it may be. And my argument would be non-alignment has always been a balance between the principle and the transaction, right? If you're a small, poor country, and you are looking for help with development financing, you know, you're a country that is not resource rich, you don't have access in the grounds to diamonds or to oil, of course you want a good relationship with oil producing countries that can help you. Of course you want a relationship with the Chinese, who, you know, they're not exactly giving out free grants for development, but they do have access to large tranches of development finance that you may want. So the principle leads in the non-aligned movement. I think that we're seeing a lot of that come out. I think that in fact, the ways in which many of these countries are condemning Russia at the level of the UN, but then retreating to a non-sanctions position does say a lot about what non-alignment is. It's a principal position, but a refusal to enter the fray of these high geopolitical conflicts. But I think that I resist the temptation of these people for me to condemn countries in Latin America or Africa that refuse sanctions and want, as the Mexicans to say, to have good relations with all governments. Because if you're a poor, even medium income country, why are you trying to, you don't have the privilege of isolating yourself, of, you know, moving towards autarky.
It's this American inability to see ourselves, others see us. So people in Washington, pundits will weigh very seriously the effect of gas prices on popular support for the war. And yet they will accept with complete insouciance the economic devastation of a third country for getting involved. They expect them to show the moral fortitude that American voters won't.
Yeah, no, I think you know, what's going to be really interesting to see, Ian, as we move deeper into this second Cold War, is, you know, the Cold War mentality always involves this kind of tension between these two geopolitical maneuvers in the Cold War. One of the geopolitical maneuvers that we're already seeing at the beginning of the new Cold War is the frivolous violation of all principle to achieve what we need to achieve, right? Screw it, we'll go talk to Maduro. We need oil, like, what do we care about our past positions on authoritarianism and democracy?
Yesterday, apparently, we gave tacit implicit authorization for Moroccan occupation of Western Sahara.
Right, exactly.
Secretary State was there, and she said, oh, we're going to carry on giving arms to Morocco because we think there's a solid basis for a settlement. The Western Saharans don't. No one else in the world does, but because it's expedient, the US does. And, exactly. And then we wonder why other people aren't going to fall on their swords for our principles.
Exactly. So the Cold War implies that this tension between, on the one hand, like, whatever it takes, kind of break the rules, deal with the bad guys, because the risks are so high, you know, domino theory, they could fall to other countries. We need to do what we need to do to consolidate our power. And the other, this escalation of principle, you know, this escalation of rhetoric, free world versus slave world, more intense and harsh judgments of countries that take the other sides, right? So it's a weird—
Saudi Arabia is so obviously part of the free world. They celebrated the invasion by executing 81 people in a day. And they're on our side, except even they didn't vote properly. And we've lost discipline. You know, our satrapies and client countries aren't doing what they're told, and no one's doing anything about it, which is interesting from a diplomatic point of view. Has the US got the discipline it used to have over its allies? I mean, a quick phone call to Riyadh would have once sorted that out. Hey, your air cover is, we're inviting the Iranians to attack you whenever they want, and up yours would have been a suitable response in a real politic term.
Yeah, I think that is a, you know, I'm trying to read these things as much as drivers of a new geopolitics as reflections of a new geopolitics, right? I think that these things, that lack of discipline you're describing is us going to Venezuela, these are reflections of a greater multipolarity in the world, right? The move towards these ad hoc and highly expedient interventions on the one hand, those ad hoc interventions, and then the programmatic escalation of rhetoric, judging countries that take the other side. You know, I think we should really expect for there to be a really true and proper new McCarthyite spirit that comes out of the United States, because I think that's where we're headed. So I think one of the things to pay attention to is going to be.
We got back there, and you mentioned it yourself. You say that we're talking in terms of a new Cold War, but there isn't a significant ideological component here. I know that loads of deranged leftists in Western Europe and US, and, you know, speaking as an underranged leftist myself on a personal level, the card-carrying member of the Socialist International, this does not, there is no ideology here. There's no way that Putin pretends to be socialist, pretends to be anti-imperialist, and yet somehow he has the full penumbra of you know, lots of delusions about Moscow as the core of the third world and revolution and counter-capitalism.
Two things on that. One is we need to ask ourselves, one thing is we need to ask ourselves, how much did the original Cold War actually rely on ideology to begin with? I think that, you know, we were dealing with two great powers that were going to use whatever was in there, Gramscian arsenal, to create the, you know, the effective attachments to their project that they needed to, right? You could ask the same thing. So there's that. The second thing, so I really see in the Russia war a dry run for a conflict between the US and China, you know? And I also think that the way in which the Russia-China alliance is already in formation tells us about, if we're going to go towards a more bipolar view of that Cold War, where that might be headed. Two of those great powers connected, possibly, you know, but certainly with China. Now, with China, Ian, we do have the benefit of saying that they're communists and literally going back into out. No, I'm not saying that they are, Ian.
They're claiming to be. Yes, I know. Yes.
What is the party to which Xi Jinping belongs, the Chinese Communist Party, they know this is an easy ghost to recall from the archive, you know, and just put communism back on trial. And certainly the US right? We're not talking about a static situation, Joe Biden being president forever. We're talking about a dynamic situation in which the right, people like Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, and certainly Donald Trump, have no problem in going straight McCarthy, you know, communism, communism, communism. That's what China is. That's communism, right? And what, you think people in the US, you know, it's not people like us who are having a conversation about which strand, variety, ice cream flavor of leftism. We're talking about people who are like, communism, bad. And if you look at the rhetoric of even the Summit for Democracy that Joe Biden has launched, they are using the language of the free world, right? So they don't even need to resort to communism, redistribution, collective ownership of the means of production. They can just say democracy. They're doing it now. Democracy, 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 right? China's not a democracy. Russia's not a democracy. Even Bernie Sanders speaks in the language of an axis of authoritarianism, right? That stretches from certainly the kind of, you know, hybrid regimes like Bolsonaro all the way to the Chinese and the Russians. This is a vocabulary that's already established, that's already in use, and just needs to have a more military.
And has some applicability, you must admit.
I'm not here to make judgments about the ideological character of the regimes. I'm saying, you're asking me, you know, is it, which is a fair question, is the Cold War framework really the relevant one? And my point is to say, without a doubt, yes, it is. I think that it is not one for one. The Soviet Union was different in character. Certainly, we need to pay attention to the ways in which both, you know, China and the United States are more imbricated economically, and the implications of that imbrication for a Cold War, which will look different than the Soviet Union, which was effectively isolated, not at all integrated into the Western capitalist economic world. That does have implications for the shape of that Cold War. But to me, where are we headed, and what is this war with Russia telling us? What is the White House kind of practicing? They're practicing for a larger geopolitical conflict with a more, let's say, sophisticated and more powerful adversary in the form of China, my guess.
Yeah, I'm not sure this particular White House is especially invested in the fight, except as a reflex. I mean, and there's much to fight about, as our journalist colleagues in Hong Kong could testify, for example, or our friends in Taiwan, the cozy social democrats who have a health service, who have free education, free trade unions. You know, if there's an ideological battle, yes, there's one to be fought, but there's a reflex, as we've pointed out, these ingrained habits that could produce a Cold War. But in the case of China, they're hedging a lot here, because they did not approve of the invasion officially. One correspondent in Odessa for a Chinese TV station embedded in the Russian forces is not exactly full-blooded approval in geopolitical terms. It's a sign, and the allegation that promises might have been made that possibly the Chinese would consider military aid. But one of the differences with the past is that whereas the Soviet Union, the Warsaw Pact, was autarkic, basically it operated in isolation from the world, China is deeply involved. It's almost like the old gladiatorial combats where the combatants were chained together. You might flash at each other with knives, but in the end, you are, you know, they are not in a position to, the equal damage to both. But the Chinese and the US are equally dependent.
Yeah.
Macy's can't sell their goods if they can't get knocked down non-union made Chinese shirts, for example.
I'm not totally convinced by the sort of du commerce kind of, you know, trade and economic interdependence make peace. But your point's well taken. I totally agree.
Not saying they make peace, but they make for caution.
yeah, totally. No, I think in China's foreign reserves are ostensibly a nuclear weapon. I think that, you know, we need to update our vocabulary of Cold War to think about, you know, economic weapons, financial weapons as being another form of mutually assured destruction as nuclear ones were, right? With huge devastation that could be caused by unleashing these sanctions. You know, the sanctions we've set against Russia are effectively nuclear. You know, they don't destroy in the kind of visible way, but they are going to destroy millions of lives across Russia and immiserate huge populations, force tons of migration, destroy families, all that kind of stuff, right? So, like, they are enacting a declaration of war, and China would be capable of, you know, inflicting tremendous damage on the global economy. The amount of the stuff that we produce in China that we rely on is crazy. So, I mean, that runs both ways in the way that you're suggesting. However, obviously, it's been the Chinese Communist Party's policy for some years now to move towards greater consumption on the domestic level. And if that continues over the course of several years, and there's a more of a shift away from an export exclusive model towards building up its own middle class, towards decoupling from the West, towards building up its own tech giants, kicking out Facebook, kicking out all those people, out Meta, like no social networks to fill the void, right? But China has already huge infrastructure that can sustain it technologically. You know, it's no longer reliant on so many of these big firms in the United States, and the yuan being competitive on the international stage vis-a-vis the dollar does create equal and opposite pressure. So I think there are many ways in which the analogy fails ideologically, economically, you know, but I think that it does help us to make sense of the US geopolitical positioning, right? Which is, you know, gather our allies in the most, with the most, with the like shiniest veneer of ideological coherence, right? Like, we'll just sweep under the rug.
But how can you do that when 50% of the political class in Washington is basically on the side of authoritarianism wherever it crops up? I mean, This is one of the points where you're referring to a US foreign policy. And I think one of the things of the last decade or so is the absence of any joined up, thought out foreign policy. It's been a set of ad hoc reflexive reactions to particular situations, and often framed in terms of domestic lobbies. You know, do you support Israel or not? Do you support Morocco or not? And it's a case of who's got the biggest checkbook in Washington that determines these, rather than a sort of patrician class of WASP foreign policy experts extrapolating the information from the world and saying, this is what a coherent foreign policy should look like. Nobody's trying to do that, as far as I can see.
Yeah, so I think that unipolarity guarantee allow creates the space for frozen. You're back.
Okay. You're frozen. The voice is coming. Carry on.
All right. Unipolarity allows for that. You know, hegemony in the world that we've enjoyed for 30 years allows for U.S. foreign policymakers to be completely ad hoc, completely devoid of principle, to just do whatever they want, because what's the reaction going to be? Who's going to challenge them on the world stage? I think my point is to say that more great power competition, if you like that framework, more multipolarity, if you choose to buy into the framework that I'm describing here, will imply more pressure for good faith coalition making on behalf of the United States. There will need to be a war for hearts and minds by the U.S., as there was in the first Cold War, to try to bring those allies on side. There was a really telling confrontation in Congress between someone from the DOD who was being interrogated. And someone from Congress was asking, I forget who it was saying, wait, hold on. So the DOD, state is going to our allies in Central and Latin and South America and offering them aid, and they're rejecting it. This is in the context of fears about Russia's influence, China's influence in the region, in our hemisphere. Mm-hmm. And the DOD was saying, you know, yeah, they don't want it. And the congresswoman was responding, well, that's really problematic. We need to find a way to get them back on side, get them better. You know, there's going to be that competitive pressure. Now, many historians will point to the ways in which that competitive pressure actually raised the bar and created room for civil rights movements to flourish in the United States, because it allowed for our adversaries to, you know, push us on the failures and misapplications of our own stated principles. But it also, you know, implies huge risks for the collateral damage, like Ukraine, right? Tons of violence at the borderlands of that new Cold War. So I think, again, we're back to that, the tensions that arise in multipolarity. So I think that, to your point, I don't disagree at all about the past two decades of U.S. foreign policymaking. I think that what Joe Biden's push for commitment to this Summit for Democracy idea, which I think they'll keep as a rolling program, is the way they speak of democracy is different than the way George Bush spoke about it in 2004, right? This is not a mission accomplished kind of, shock and awe, bring democracy with a fist. This is, let's get together, let's build these alliances, let's bring, we need India to be the kind of bulwark against China. How do we do that? We build this relationship.
So we need India. I mean, this is where reality impinges on us. We need India to be our democratic ally when it's ruled by a prime minister who is a sectarian person who uses pogroms against the Muslims as a tool of policy, who's repressing Kashmir. So it does not bode well. Once again, we're stuck with this position as the, allies. We do not create our allies. We grab and pick them off the shelves, whether they fit or not.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that paying attention to those cases is going to be critical for evaluating the extent to which the new Cold War effort is gesturing towards an earnest attachment, earnest commitment to democratic institutions, right? But there's, to me, again, I'm trying to read the war in Ukraine, not just in terms of what's happening there, but in terms of what it's telling us about the direction of U.S. foreign policy making and what I believe people in Washington, and Ian, I'm curious for your thoughts here, are learning, what they're learning. I think that they're learning that there is a well of goodwill among allies in Europe from which they can draw. There's the narrative of defending democracy, defending people against those great powers, that's really powerful, that's something that they can apply and apply again, not just to the potential of a Chinese invasion of Taiwan, but even in any kind of conflict in the South China Sea could be construed as a new borderland that needs to be defended for freedom. And that stuff is landing. It's landing in the US press corps. It's landing in Europe. It's reviving NATO in a way that I'm sure you and I are shocked to see NATO in the headlines hailed as some kind of savior with the potential to defend people as opposed to kind of on the front lines of aggression against, people in the MENA region, right? So,
NATO, I always like to remind people, was a product of a prominent member of the Socialist International. It was Ernest Bevin in the US, in the UK, who wanted to defend democratic socialism. And he invented NATO, as he said, to keep the Russians out, the Germans down, and the Americans in, which was based on sound geopolitical principles at the time.
But you know what? Like that same line could not be more relevant today. So that's why I see the parallels are so strong and the historical echo is so loud when it comes to the original Cold War. Anyway, Simon has a question here.
Yes, I was about to say, that's the next one, Simon. I mean, Simon is saying, I've heard African countries explain they're not standing up against Russia because they're concerned about food supplies. Is that the real reason? It is a very genuine concern which needs addressing separately, but I would see personally Russia as the threat to the food supplies rather than the other way around. After all, Ukraine is not burning its breadbasket. It's Russia that's sending tanks through and knocking the crops down. What do you think?
No, I think that's right. I mean, I think that Ukraine produces tons of wheat, and we're looking at spikes in prices precisely because of the Russian invasion. I think it's more the African countries are like
fertilizer as well. Well,
Russia, makes a lot of raw materials. I mean, there's, like I said, oil and other kinds of economic support that flow to these countries in the Global South that are really important. And I think you have to, getting into the mind of those Global South governments, you're like, why, what exactly do I gain? The U.S. is such an unreliable ally when it comes to development needs, totally frivolous when it comes to its commitments to international law. So what exactly am I gaining by standing up against a potential source of financial and economic support, namely Russia and all the group of countries that have kind of aligned there? I think that's where not just Africans come from, but Bangladesh comes from. There's this call to stand up for the principle, and oftentimes that this goes to the kind of transactional aspects of this. There are needs in these countries and are trying to take care of their populations. So I think that will, you know, there's probably going to be a decoupling of the conversation around the invasion and the conversation around food prices, as there should. You know, it's not like the U.S. doesn't make any crops. It's not like we don't, you know, our free trade agreements don't have anything to do with agriculture. So, you know, I think that there is a lot of there could be a decoupling of that conversation where they don't want to, you know, go too hard against. It's not like sanctioning Russia gets you closer to getting the food prices down from the invasion of Ukraine, right? So there's this goes to the conversation about what sanctions are and are not able to accomplish on behalf of those countries in the global south. So there's another kind of question.
But you mentioned it before about, we mentioned the joined up foreign policy. The Chinese Belt and Road Initiative shows how seriously they take foreign policy. They got their economic development policy, whereas the project for the new century, the American version, was about how many missiles we get into space and intimidate our opponents. The Chinese are buying, are ignoring, not ignoring space, but they're buying the ground from under the West by the Belt and Road Initiative. Billions of dollars going, and you know, there's very understandable questions being asked about the motivation and the use of those as people who've gone bankrupt and had to sell their ports at, and facilities at fire sale prices to the Chinese. But it's a very effective joined up way of conducting foreign policy, which the US has hitherto proven utterly incapable of.
No, Ian, that's madness. This was exactly our plan. This was the Marshall Plan. The Marshall Plan, and by the way,
I'm talking recently. Yes, I know originally, but the last 20 years, giving money to foreigners has been interdicted by the know-nothings in Congress, pretty much, unless it is Israel. But everywhere
I think we can have. I think we can have a more detailed conversation about what exactly has happened past 20 years. What I would argue in the past 20 years is that we haven't forgotten that mission. Jim Kim did at the World Bank. Jim Kim initiated this billions to trillions model that basically said, okay, the World Bank is going to basically insource tons of private finance by assetizing, doing exactly what you said, Ian, that the Chinese are doing, assetizing, you know, mountains and ports and railroads and letting private investors from Wall Street, from these big from these private equity firms and hedge funds, basically buy up infrastructure, assetize it, securitize it, financialize it, right? So we're doing that. We're just doing that with the motive of basically rent seeking and profiteering on behalf of our Wall Street and Stamford, Connecticut firms. Whereas the Chinese are doing it in a much more holistic and state-driven way. So it's not like, you know, they're doing it, we're not, right? We're doing it the same time, we're doing it in different ways. But when it comes to Belt and Road, there's no doubt with the Marshall Plan. Yes, but I think to answer Simon's point in the context of the conversation we've been having, this is more Cold War stuff, right? This is more, I give you this and we form that geopolitical alliance. Now, does that buy subservience? No, it buys, you know, a certain, it raises the stakes, let's say, it raises the costs to, you know, any kind of action against China or taking sides with the US. Of course, that's the nature of economic exchange. That's the nature of interpersonal exchange, right? You know, I have a best friend, we're very, very close friends. You know, he hurt somebody else's feelings, and then I'm supposed to speak out against my friend. Well, we're good friends. I mean, this is the nature of all relationships in a way. So I think that we are too quick to impugn like shady motives. Of course, there is a motivation. This isn't pure charity, and it should never be understood as pure charity, just in the same way that nothing the US ever does is pure charity. I don't think we have to be like psychotic IR realists to think that geopolitics is not the realm of, you know, pure principle and charitable efforts. You know, even the Peace Corps is shot through with, you know, US geopolitical concerns and kind of CIA initiatives and stuff like that. So I don't think that China right now is applying pressure to its allies to not take a stand against Putin. Of course, that's my intuition. I haven't spoken with those foreign ministries to make sure that there's no Chinese influence there. But again, I think that people are reading the tea leaves. I think that these countries are reading the tea leaves. And if there is an attachment to China that relates to Russia, it's to say that these countries don't want to be hemmed in to some vacuous and totally thin or fragile alliance against a power like Russia, right? Because they just don't want to get involved in those things. And a more multipolar world means that they don't have to get involved. They don't have to take one of those sides. And there's going to be increased pressure on them to take sides. The US legislation on countering adversaries through sanctions act, CAST or something like that, allows us to sanction third countries that take the other side in our Cold War efforts, right? Classic Cold War stuff, right? We have the stick ready. And then we're going to go around and, you know, offer some carrots when necessary, right? But I think that, you know, if we want to talk about sticks or implicit sticks, like the Chinese are there being like, hey, we invested, you know, certainly a country like Pakistan is really caught in the grip of that multipolar tension. But, you know, all sides have their sticks ready to beat the third countries who fail to take the line that their governments are giving.
Well, one of the, you know, the issue here was the original Teddy Roosevelt about speaking softly and carrying a big stick. Whereas for many years now, the US, not a question of value judgment, has been shouting quite a lot, but it's everyone's very dubious over whether it can ever wield a stick with the divided nature of politics in Washington. Republicans support some foreign interventions and will accuse Biden of being a chicken if he doesn't take them up. But the minute he actually tries to do something, they will then shout against him and say he's getting us into foreign wars. So the room for flexibility is for subtlety, for nuance. I remember George W. Bush told his speech writers he didn't want none of that nuance in his speeches. And there's, in real terms, not that much room for nuance from Washington's responses, is there, because of the domestic political inhibitions?
Yeah. I mean, you know, let's not forget that the executive still has a lot of authority to, and certainly the executive is in charge of sanctions policy. So these are not congressional efforts. Certainly there are, you know, people in Congress who've been working on war powers resolutions to try to claw back some of the war making capacity that the executive has back to legislative. But for all intents and purposes, war remains the province of the executive. And the entire fight against Putin with respect to Ukraine has been waged through the executive almost exclusively. So yeah, I think that there are domestic political constraints, and there is a sense in which the we might even say isolationist impulses of some of the Trump or Trumpian aspects of the Republican Party are a constraint. But I insist, the more we move into this Cold War footing, the more the Cold War framing becomes adopted and deployed, the more centripetal pressure there's going to be on the US political system. And I think that what we're going to find is this is very useful for Biden because, as you say, Ian, it cuts through the Republican Party. You have people like Marco Rubio, who are the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who are totally bought into the Cold War, totally bought in, totally getting off on the secret calls with Zelensky, on this intelligence about Russian invasion, are all in for like taking this on, fighting communism, super upset about the Maduro stuff, right? Then you've got the
if in doubt, invade Cuba.
Yeah, right. But the Trumpian wing of the party, who's like parroting Putinist propaganda, who's actually like praising Putin. This is bad for Republicans. So that centripetal aspect, you know, we still have a very strong. We thought it was gone.
Bad for them, but it does seem to be evoking a chord in the electorate.
I think it's working. I think that the rally around the flag effect is working. I think what's really interesting, I know we're coming to the end of our hour, especially for you, Ian, who's you know, affiliated to the Quincy people, is we just had a conversation about endless war. And we just, at the highest levels, we have a president who committed in his presidential campaign and then in his, in the White House to taking on endless war, to doing something about it. But my claim here today is that we are entering a new cycle of endless war, that the Cold War framing allows for these ad hoc, endlessly justifiable interventions that can be, you know, blamed on Putin, blamed on Xi, And that is going to be the next 20 years, another endless war that doesn't look like military bases, but does look like a blank check for the executive and for its friends in the intelligence community to do whatever it takes to beat back the commies and reclaim democracy for the free world.
So I suppose the final question to finish, David, is you're a foreign policy advisor to Bernie Sanders, who, as we know, lost the election. What can be done about it domestically and internationally to muffle the war drums?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think that the most basic thing with the most radical implications is to actually say mean what we say, to expand, to try to demand a more universal application of the principles that we are espousing in the course of this conflict to all the parts of U.S. foreign policy, right? And that's what these global South countries are asking for, to say, okay, fine, you want to stand up for international law? Fantastic. Now let's actually apply those same strictures of international law to all forms of U.S.
In the Golan Heights and the Western Sahara and so on and so on.
Yeah, in Havana, everywhere. So I think that, what is to be done is not to say, I mean, we can have a conversation all day long about sanctions against Russia. But I think the point is to say the impulse that I think is shared across the U.S. electorate to defend democratic institutions is one that needs to be nurtured. It's one that I think is very important and healthy for a country that considers itself to be a defender of democratic principles domestically. But the point is to say, the crisis in Ukraine needs to be an opportunity for those principles to flourish in the other realms of US foreign policymaking. We need to resist the temptation. The war footing excuses further violations of international law because everything is justified by the fact that the project we're defending is so big, is so important that, eviscerating and eliminating a country like Cambodia or Vietnam is worth it. A lot of commentators are saying in Ukraine, it's worth basically sacrificing all the lives of people in Ukraine for the principle, right? But taking that principle and trying to make it stick in the other realms of U.S. foreign policymaking. I think that's what I see a lot of, that's what I see Senator Bernie Sanders doing. I see a lot of people in the Democratic camp who are trying to lend cautious support to the U.S. government while trying to ensure that their critique of the broader architecture of U.S. foreign policy is not lost in the loud horn of war that is being blown from Pennsylvania.
It is like looking in a mirror sometimes when you see that the Russian army is destroying Russian-speaking cities in Ukraine to save their population from genocide. The echoes of Vietnam really do, for us older campaigners, really do come back. But we're obviously suffering from some form of cyber interference. I'd like to think it was the FSB and they thought we were important enough, but I doubt it. It's just a Commoner Garden, Time Warner and similar cable owners not able to maintain the infrastructure. So I'd like to thank you very much, David, and thank everybody else for coming to the Foreign Policy Association Brewing. Do please join, sign up for more briefings and send us suggestions for others and conversations. And our next, I believe it's next Wednesday, we have, this week we have Trita Parsi coming from the Quincy Institute, who's spoken to us before about Iran. And Iran suddenly has new relevance because the JCPOA, a great example of American insouciance to international law when it doesn't suit. It doesn't suit lobbies at home. Whether it's a geopolitical necessity is another story. And we can look because, obviously, the war in the Ukraine, if globalization's, it's gone beyond anything since the Second World War. If famine in Africa is a result of a conflict in Central Europe and Eastern Europe, then the world is really going. We have conflicts in Latin America. Who knows? there's a lot at stake. Thank you very much, David, for putting it in perspective. And we'll see you soon, I hope. Do keep in touch. And it's a bit, Bernie's not going to make it next time, is he? But it would be good. It would be good because he's been a paragon on foreign policy over the last few years. Thank you very much, everybody. See you again soon.